The Fed met, economic growth numbers came out, Japan went negative. I personally would say it's a week just screaming for a wrap-up, but maybe that's just me. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the last one of January. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. I say Friday like it's nothing, but this has actually been a week of note in the global economy. So here with what happened and why, Catherine Rampell writes for The Washington Post. Cardiff Garcia is at the blog FT Alphaville. They are both in our brand spanking new studios in New York City. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kat.
So, Catherine, let's get to the Fed first of all, I suppose. We'll do this in chronological order. It's not like it's any surprise that they came out and said, ooh, wait a minute, things aren't as good as we thought. But it was a little shocking, a little jarring to see it in print from the Fed, yeah?
I don't know. I think expectations were that the Fed was going to take its time with its next rate hike. Janet Yellen has been saying again and again and again, this will be a very shallow, I think is her word, very shallow increase in rates, that they're taking their time. You know, they didn't rule out raising rates at their March meeting, but it's possible. I'm a little skeptical if that'll come.
Yeah, okay. Cardiff, let me ask you this, though. Forget raising of rates. Do you suppose if things continue to be as squishy as they have been, certainly since late last year, do you suppose they could turn around and reverse themselves? I know that's a little bit, you know, nuclear Armageddon here. But
I mean, look, they could, but I think things would actually have to get drastically worse from where they are now. But it is true that the Fed is about to get a test of its promises throughout the last couple of years when they've said that their actions are going to be dependent on the incoming data. The incoming data right now are awfully squishy, I think was the word you used.
That's the technical economic word. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, so they're going to get a test of it. We're going to see how they react.
Catherine, data dependent might as well be Janet Yellen's middle name. I mean, she says it every time she's asked the question. She looked at the global economy as well and didn't like what she saw there either.
That's right. I mean, that's where most of our risks come from right now. If you look at how the U.S. economy is doing, I know we're going to get to GDP probably in a second,
but
the job market has been quite strong.
Yep.
We've had a lot of new people, a lot of people going back to work, a lot of new jobs being created. We've even seen a little bit of wage growth, finally.
A little tiny bit, right?
But the big risks come from places like China, come from, you know, what are the ramifications of the global oil markets continuing to see oil prices fall. And other developing countries as well. But yeah, the U.S. at home looks pretty strong relative to the rest of the world.
Well, Cardiff, so bring me back home then and talk to me about gross domestic product. We got a first look at Q4 this morning. It was lousy, 0.7%. Discuss.
Yeah, we've gotten these surprising numbers before at the start of the year, and then it's turned out that they've improved later on. So there might be a seasonal component to this. That said, boy, I wish we'd get a surprise in the other direction just once. You know, that'd be nice. So I think the context is also different from the last few years. We're not in a situation where the Fed is keeping rates at the floor. It's thinking about raising. And we also have all this activity going on in the rest of the world. So things are a little bit different. So, it's not great. It might be nothing, but it's not great.
Catherine, let me ask you, it's almost pejorative to say it. I want to ask you the R word, recession. Let's remember this expansion's been going on for a long time.
In Janet Yellen's words, I'm skeptical of the idea that expansions die of old age.
Yes,
it's not like it's not like just because we've been expanding for a really long time, we're due to fall. You have to actually see problems in the markets. You have to see like there are risks, you know, lurking somewhere in the job market and housing or something to justify an actual recession. I think talk of a recession right now is very overblown.
Way too premature for that. I mean, some parts of the economy are somewhat resilient. They're slowing down a bit, but things like consumer spending, the housing market, those things are okay. So there are a lot of risks. There are more risks now than there were throughout last year, but it's way too premature to be talking about a recession.
All right. Important to remember. Cardiff Garcia at the blog FT Alphaville. Catherine Rampell writes for The Washington Post. I encourage you, by the way, to check out Catherine's column today. It's a great one. Have a good weekend, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
You bet. All right, so on Wall Street today, by the by, all sunshine and light, baby. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today's the seventh anniversary of the first law that President Obama signed after he took office. It's called the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which made it easier for people to file paycheck discrimination lawsuits. Telling you that so I can tell you this, today the president restarted at the federal level the conversation we have about pay, gender, and race and equity in this country every now and then. He also proposed a new requirement for American businesses. Companies with more than 100 employees would have to submit wage data every year, data broken down by race, ethnicity, and gender. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports now from Washington on what the government might do with that data.
Don't get all excited. This probably won't allow you to see how much money your colleagues make. This change is primarily for the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Ariane Hegovich is with the Institute for Women's Policy Research.
What the EOC is planning to do is to analyze the data and to prepare regional and industry metrics.
Translation.
Once we put all those figures into a statistical model, you can then identify the companies that are clearly below par.
Why does that matter? The Obama administration says it will help better spot discrimination. But there's a reason companies don't usually like to report this kind of pay data. Nancy Hammer of the Society for Human Resource Management said in a written statement, "Compensation data is especially sensitive and confidential as it provides insight into an organization's strategies. The official policy isn't out until Monday, and there will be a little something for workers." Emily Martin is with the National Women's Law Center.
You won't be able to look up how much Marketplace is paying people by race and gender, but I think you will be able to look up how much employers in that locality are paying people by race and gender in that occupational category.
And Martin says, more importantly, when companies are compiling all this information, they can't claim they didn't know a gender or race wage gap exists in their workplace. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We went out on Twitter this morning, by the way, and asked if you would disclose your salaries. A lot of you did on Twitter. We've got the results on our website, marketplace.org. Today, the Bank of Japan announced it's pushing one of its key interest rates below zero. The idea, macroeconomically speaking, is to keep deflation at bay and, if they're lucky, even get some inflation going in an economy, mind you, that has been stuck in a two-decade-long economic funk. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes it from there.
There are boatloads of cash parked at Japan's central bank. It's holding piles of yen for the commercial banks and paying out a little interest. But with the negative interest rates, the Bank of Japan will be charging banks to hold their money. This will only apply to new deposits, according to Anil Kashyap, an economist at the University of Chicago.
The intention is to try to reduce the bank's willingness to keep money parked, instead to try to lend it out or to buy some other securities.
But people, even banks in Japan, don't like spending money. They spent years in a deflationary spiral. Prices just kept falling. People and banks save their cash because why buy something today when its price will be lower tomorrow? So will the negative interest rate work?
That's the 1 trillion yen question.
Michael Taylor is a senior economist at Oxford Economics in London.
In terms of the banks rushing out and reallocating these reserves towards bank lending, I'm very skeptical about that.
But Taylor says the banks might have better luck buying stocks or bonds. They have made some investments like that, but in other countries. Sheila Smith is a senior fellow on Japan at the Council on Foreign Relations.
There's a certain barrier here to really changing the economic behavior.
Smith says it's especially hard to change that behavior when much of the rest of the global economy is so uncertain. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The most feared insect in the world right now is the mosquito. We were talking yesterday about the business impact of the Zika virus, which is, thanks to mosquitoes, spreading at an alarming rate in South America and has been found here in the United States. Zika has also brought mosquitoes back into focus at a time, winter, when most of this country doesn't really have to deal with them. Turns out, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour discovered, mosquitoes are an industry unto themselves.
The U.S. is at war and has been for decades. We have used precision smart bombs. We have used military bombers and foot soldiers on the ground. You know the enemy. You know it way too well.
We've got 714 named mosquito control districts in the United States.
Joseph Conlon is a medical entomologist with the American Mosquito Control Association. Mosquito control districts are independent but tax-funded. They operate like school boards or water utilities, but just all about killing mosquitoes.
The last reliable statistics we have is in 1999, and they were spending about $235 million for a year.
Budgets range from a few thousand to $20 million. Public health is one reason.
Dengue used to be quite prevalent in the United States. Yellow fever used to be quite prevalent in the United States. As of 1935, we had 125,000 cases of malaria transmitted in the United States.
As new diseases have emerged, the industry has grown.
Prior to West Nile virus in the U.S., mosquito control was reserved for places like Florida, the southeast United States.
Jason Trombetta is VP of sales at Adapco, which sells mosquito control products.
And after West Nile virus became endemic in the continental U.S., you saw places that you wouldn't typically think, like rural Pennsylvania.
He says the industry probably grew 30% in 2 years after West Nile. One of the larger mosquito control districts is in the Florida Keys. Mike Doyle is executive director.
Give you an idea, we put a trap out a few years ago on one of the local islands and collected 250,000 mosquitoes in one night.
That's 8 mosquito bites a second for 14 hours.
It's the reason that people didn't move to Florida a couple hundred years ago. If we didn't have a mosquito program in the Keys, in Key West, you would have a tourist season of about three months a year instead of 12 months a year.
Doyle spends about $10 million a year to make the Florida Keys the Florida Keys instead of hell on earth. He does it in a lot of different ways.
We have helicopters, 4 helicopters that fly and put out about 500,000 pounds, it's over $1 million worth of granules that have a bacteria.
The bacteria kill mosquitoes and black flies. They don't harm people or other insects.
These helicopters are zooming like an acrobatic show back and forth across the roads and over marshes and over houses to drop these granules, you know, very strategic kind of smart bomb-like precision into marshes.
There are also trucks that spray pesticides, but the most expensive battle is fighting the specific species of disease-bearing mosquitoes that don't breed in salt marshes, but rather in plant saucers and other containers in people's homes and backyards.
It's like urban warfare. You have to have individual soldiers, in this case inspectors for us, going door to door.
This is the fastest growing part of Doyle's budget, and it's the part no mosquito control district can do alone.
The general public really does need to be involved in protecting their own health.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So I actually ran out of gas in the gas station while trying to find a pump that was open.
Huh. You know what, though? There's an app to fix that. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 396 points on this Friday, 2.4%. 16,466 is the number you're looking for. The NASDAQ up 107 points, 2.3%. Finished at 4613. The S&P 500 grew 46 points, 2.4%, ended at 1940. Here is the week gone by. The Dow up 2.3%, the NASDAQ up 0.5%, the S&P 500 added 1.7%. We told you a bit about mosquitoes and the Zika virus. So here's a look at some of the big names in pesticides. Rollins, owner of Orkin and some other pest control services worldwide, up 4.5%. Today, Dow Chemical increased 1%. The Swiss agrochemical company Syngenta up 1.8%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.92%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Crude closed up today a percent or so for the U.S. benchmark in New York, but it's been a tumultuous year and a half on the downside for oil. So, as with all things market-related, what happens now? You can be sure the pros, the analysts, and the investors are looking to past busts for enlightenment. And one narrative making the rounds on Wall Street of late suggests oil is falling apart the same way subprime mortgages did, and that the bust could last just as long. Maybe. Maybe not. We don't know yet. But why do we always look to yesterday for clues to tomorrow? From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong is on that one.
Like snowflakes, no two bubbles are the same. And yet there's comfort in using yesterday's bust to try to explain what's happening today and maybe predict the future. Alex Dryden at JP Morgan is global market strategist in London.
You do always see people drawing parallels between what we're seeing in energy and what we're seeing in markets to tech bubbles and real estate bubbles that we've seen in the past.
One chart plotting the fall of crude oil prices is a dead ringer for subprime mortgages back in 2008. The correlation is crazy high. But correlation is not causation. Ed Herz at the oil firm Hillhouse Resources teaches economics at the University of Houston. He recalls back in grad school.
My classmate Mark Grinblatt regressed GNP growth against the incidence of sunspots and dysentery in Scotland.
He had the highest correlation in the class.
So he won the case of beer.
With market predictions, there's good and there's bad technical analysis. Sometimes past performance is predictive. And with so much uncertainty about oil in the world economy, the pros are looking for some sign for tomorrow. Spencer Cutter is an energy credit analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence.
They're not only looking for the length of the downturn, but the severity of the downturn to try to find, you know, where is the bottom? Because nobody knows what is the right price for oil. Is it $30 a barrel, $40 a barrel, $80 a barrel? There is no empirical right price.
The one thing safe to say, and it is safe in this context, is yes, it's different this time. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The host of our weekend show, Lizzie O'Leary, is just back from a week in Flint, Michigan, reporting on the water crisis. There she filed a couple of stories for us about how it's affecting people's lives and where things might go from here. We got her back on the line to get some final thoughts, a wrap-up of sorts. Hey, Lizzie.
Hi, Kai.
So I guess the question really is, you know, what I set us up with here. Now what happens to these people? The money's coming, the water's coming, but they are still there, right?
Yeah, I think there are two answers to that question. Number one is about time frame, and number two is about authority. Time frame is sort of this idea of when do they move off emergency footing? And a lot of that is knit together with a question of when people will be able to drink water coming out of their tap. And then the question of authority, which is who do they listen to? Because public trust in Flint, as you can imagine, is very low.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the kids that were in that story that you did for us yesterday and what their parents had to say. And that was stuff that was long-term lasting impact.
Yeah. And I think one of the big questions is we don't know how big that impact is going to be on these kids. I talked to Philip Liddell, one of the fathers in that story. I spent a lot of time with him and his family. He hasn't had the chance to get his kids tested yet, in part because, you know, he doesn't have a car. I mean, this is an economically depressed city. So I was sort of talking with him about, well, what are you doing? He said, it's still the same. We've still got the bottled water. I want to get the kids tested, but I got to figure out how I can even make that happen.
Where do things stand with actual delivery of water? When we spoke, I guess, on Monday or Tuesday, it was they still had to come every day in the morning to get a case of water, and they did that every single day. Is that still going on?
That's still going on, and it's sort of one case per household per day for free at these water handout sites. Other people are kind of giving charitable donations at Philip Liddell's apartment building, which is sort of a building where a lot of low-income people live. Some volunteers came by with a big truck of water and delivered it to the building because a lot of the older folks there, you know, just don't have the means to get to the delivery sites. And also, if you're a family of five, six, seven, one case of water per day does not cut it.
Yeah. The number from the introduction to your piece yesterday, $28 million from the Michigan State Legislature going to Flint. That's on top of some earlier money. Spitball it for me, the price tag to fix this, if that's even possible.
You know, I think it's partly possible because you have to think about where's the money going. Some of it will probably go to the school system. The superintendent told me they need a lot of money. They have a $10 million budget deficit in the school system anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Then there's the question of replacing the pipes. That could be a multi-million, if not hundreds of millions of dollar question once they figure out where the lead lines are. And then the medical care. And, you know, that's sort of a thing that's hanging out there when we figure out what the lead levels are in kids' blood and what kind of supportive services they might need over the next few years.
Lizzie O'Leary is the host of our weekend program, Marketplace Weekend. It's called. Lizzie, thanks a bunch. Just back, by the way, from a week in Flint, Michigan. We'll talk to you soon.
Of course. Thanks, Kai.
Nothing is certain in life, it's been said, except death and taxes and having to put gas in your car. And yes, I know, let's just discount electric vehicles for now, all right? You own a car, you got to go to the gas station. Most of us, though, see things the way they are. Entrepreneurs see industries ripe for disruption. There's a new startup in Texas that wants to bring the fuel to you, Uber, but for your gas tank. From KERA in Fort Worth, Christopher Connolly has that story.
Elizabeth Tolentino hates going to the gas station, like seriously hates it. She used to keep a gas can in her trunk because she'd run out of gas. She even ran out of gas at the gas station one time.
Every time I tried to get to a pump, someone else would take the pump before I got there, so I actually ran out of gas in the gas station while trying to find a pump that was open.
Awkward, but not anymore. Nowadays, the marketing assistant from Kennedale gets her gas delivered to her black Honda Civic Coupe. She opens an app, toggles the map to her location, and orders a fill-up.
And it asks me to pop my fuel door. So I just open my fuel door. It's processing, and it's done. Fuel's on the way, and it's going to arrive no later than 4 p.m. today.
What we do is fundamentally the 21st century way of delivering a product like this.
Frank Mycroft founded Booster Fuels. The 30-year-old used to work for NASA and for a company that wants to mine asteroids. But he wanted to use his logistics expertise to solve more terrestrial problems. Americans make an estimated 37 million trips to the gas station to fill the tank every day. That's according to the National Association of Convenience Stores, which represents gas stations. Mycroft says that adds up to a lot of wasted time.
The fact that we get thousands of families that extra 15 minutes a day to do whatever it is that they want to do, that feels really, really good.
But delivery is a tough business model, says Suresh Kota at the University of Washington's Foster School of Business, especially for gas. Once you take out the taxes and the base cost of the gas itself, there's not a lot left over. And that's got to pay for marketing and IT and personnel before you even get a penny of profit.
How much does it cost for that labor? And how much does it cost to get the product to you as opposed to you coming and picking up the product?
Ben Benson at the University of Texas McComb School of Business says sticking to dense areas is the key. Right now, Booster's only serving a handful of office parks in North Texas and Silicon Valley. The company's two competitors also serve narrow areas.
They're going to have to think about how they can market this in a way that gets the attention of the customers they want, those that are in dense areas, without being too annoying to those that love the concept but can't be served.
Then there are safety concerns. Gasoline is a hazardous material, after all, and there are regulations to make sure gas stations can handle fires or spills. Booster Fuel says it hires experienced drivers with hazmat training, people like William Rich. Out in a call center parking lot on the edge of Fort Worth, Rich unrolls a long hose from one of Booster's purple trucks. He flips on a pump and starts filling up a sporty BMW. The gas going in is a few cents cheaper than it is at a gas station down the street. While the gas is pumping, Rich cleans the windows. It's an old-timey service for what he thinks is the future of fuel delivery.
Someday, soon, I believe that Booster will be not like an option or a luxury. I think it'll be the standard. I mean, you push a button to get pizza, why not push a button to get gas?
Even if this is how we fill up in the future, you'll still have to stop off for the slushies and Slim Jims. So far, Booster has no plans to deliver those. In Fort Worth, I'm Christopher Connolly for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
This final note on the way out today, after which you may have less respect for Warren Buffett than you do before you hear what I'm about to say. There is word today that Buffett has signed on as an advisor to the new host of Celebrity Apprentice. That would be Arnold Schwarzenegger, to whom Buffett also provided counsel during Schwarzenegger's 2003 run for California governor. It's not like Buffett needs the reality TV money, of course, but things do seem to be working out for the guy who used to be on that show. Am I right? .396 points was the upside on the Dow today, 2.4%. The NASDAQ up 107 points, 2.3%. The S&P 500 closed the week out 46 points higher today, 2.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. We will be back here on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.